My name is Kishore Chandiramani, and I welcome you all to the first in a series of 6 sessions on stress management. In this first session, I'll be discussing what causes stress and the principle of impermanence, which can be used to manage the stress. Now, looking at what causes stress, the first and foremost cause is the judgment that we make. Judgments about different situations in terms of good, bad, right, wrong, beautiful, ugly, intelligent, stupid, nice, nasty, about ourselves and about others. There's nothing wrong about making those judgments. If those judgments are based on a realistic appraisal of the situation, they're not disproportionate and don't last longer than needed. The next cause of stress is our inability to accept change. We want the same things that satisfy us to continue indefinitely, or we get easily bored by the sameness and want change, which is not happening. The change is happening all the time, constantly, irrespective of whether we like it or not. The next thing that causes stress, and it's related to the one we have just discussed, is separation and loss, or a fear of it. A fear of death manifests in many disguises, such as fear of heights, flights, traveling, driving on motorways, crowded places, close places. And most panic attacks are about fear of death or losing control over oneself. A further cause of stress is our inability to understand the true nature of human life, by which I mean the true nature of our own being and that of the external world. The next thing that can give rise to stress is wanting to be in control of our lives all the time. We want to be in full control of our lives, our situations, our surroundings, our thoughts, our loved ones, our feelings, and anything unwanted that happens to us gives rise to stress. The next cause of stress is selfishness of people who are close to us. If we examine it closely, it is our own selfishness that can make us prone to hurt in the face of others' selfishness. A completely selfless person is more immune to the hurt resulting from others' selfishness. Every relationship, no matter how close it is, has its own boundaries. And beyond those boundaries, we are all alone. We are all following our own life trajectories, which are different from those of other people. The next cause of stress is relationships. And both the extremes of being in a relationship can give rise to stress. On one hand, there is loneliness, where we get the feeling that the other person doesn't care about us enough, and we are left to our own devices. There's no togetherness. And at the other extreme, there is enmeshment, that is, too much involvement to the point of controlling each other and having a lot of expectations from the other person, which can be stifling. One can visualize loneliness not as a situation or a state that one is in, but as an emotion like any other emotion, such as anxiety, depression, anger, and it comes and goes. The next cause of stress is how we evaluate our lives. Whether we see ourselves as successful or a failure. And the answer to that question is both. We are successful and we are failures in our lives. We should refrain from making any global judgments of success or failure, but go deep and try to analyze and make a list of ways in which we have been successful and ways in which we have been failures. My name is Kishore Chandiramani and I welcome you all to this second in a series of 6 sessions on stress management. In this second session, I'll be discussing a model of the mind that can help us understand the common psychological symptoms and how they are produced. The mind can be understood in terms of 2 broad compartments, the conscious and the unconscious. The conscious mind is just the tip of an iceberg, and the rest is the unconscious. According to a rough estimate, only about 10 to 20% of our mind is conscious, and the rest is unconscious. The psychological implication of this is that when we experience extreme emotions, we have to say to ourselves that we are talking about only the 10 or 20% of the mind that is conscious, and the rest is unknown to us. The remaining 80 to 90% contains joys and sorrows that may be many times greater than the joys and sorrows we experience in our day-to-day life. It's important to understand that the experiences from the unconscious mind are constantly influencing our behavior. It is the unconscious mind which, although tiny, remains in good control of the unconscious mind. There are moments when the conscious mind gets overwhelmed by the unconscious mind for short periods of time. And this is when panic attacks, psychotic symptoms, and occasional suicidal thoughts that the person doesn't want to carry out at other times emerge. There are 2 different parts of the mind. The one that experiences an emotion can be described as the experiencing self, and the other part of the mind that is free from stress can be described as the observing self. Most therapies focus on changing the experiencing self, that is, our thoughts and emotions, whereas this program is aimed at changing the observing self, that is, changing the way we understand and emotionally respond to our own thoughts and emotions, which eventually changes our experiencing self. When we feel happy about something, or if the mind is constantly creating positive experiences, it is not free to work on the negative experiences. It's therefore logical to say that if one wants to work on the negative emotions, one has to let go of one's preoccupation and engagement with positive emotions for short periods of time. Psychological stress can be understood in terms of a gap between the demands placed on us and our ability to cope with them. If the demands are high, but the coping ability is also high, there will be no stress. Contrary to that, if the demands are normal or average, but the coping ability is low, there will be stress. To put it simply, I'd like to say that we can deal with stress at the mental level and at the physical level. And we can combine different strategies and work at both the levels rather than working at one or the other. The biofeedback treatment and relaxation exercises work at the physical level to undo the effects of stress. Whereas cognitive therapies, mindfulness meditation, existential psychotherapy, and psychoeducation deal with the stress at the mental level. Now, I'd like to spend a few minutes on the physiology of stress. There are two types of physiological reactions, one that's under our control and the other that is outside our control. The nervous system that is outside our control is called autonomic nervous system. And this has two further components to it, the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. With anxiety disorder, the system prepares itself for an emergency when there is no actual emergency. It's like pressing the accelerator when the car is stationary. It leads to engine revving up. This is exactly what happens with anxiety disorder patients, where innocuous situations are being interpreted as threatening and catastrophic, leading to sympathetic overactivity. Security alarms are set off when there is no real emergency. My name is Kishore Chandiramani, and I welcome you all to the third in a series of 6 sessions on stress management. The topics for today's discussion are how to fine-tune one's judgments and how to deal with the ghost emotions. This involves learning to suspend judgments, that is, being less judgmental and not identifying with some of our thoughts and feelings. The psychological stress can be understood in terms of an emotional reaction that happens in response to a situation. And it's important to note that it is not the actual situation that causes stress, but how we perceive it. The question is how to become less judgmental. And for that, there are 4 or 5 different things that one can keep in mind. The first and the foremost is to say to ourselves that all judgments that we make are relative and not absolute. If I say to myself, I am rich, but then compared to many people, I am not that rich. If I say I am poor, then compared to a lot of people, I am not that poor. And this can be applied to any judgment about health, knowledge, success in life, and so on. In mathematics, if 2 plus 2 is 4, then it can't be 6 or 8. But in psychology, the two opposites can be equally true. For example, one can say, we live in a caring and friendly world. And the opposite of it, that this world is indifferent to our needs and uncaring, is equally true. People are loving and caring, and people are selfish. Both these statements are equally true. There is an ultimate meaning in life, and there is no ultimate meaning, as everything disintegrates eventually. Both these viewpoints would be equally true. I am a successful person, and I am a failure, both are equally true, depending upon the yardstick we use. This world is a beautiful place to live in. And the saying that the beauty lies in the eyes of the beholder are equally true. The thought of relativity of all our judgments can help us become less rigid and judgmental about ourselves and others. Human life is very complex, and we don't know the inside stories of people's lives. So making judgments about them is likely to cause unnecessary emotions. Normally, I ask my clients that whenever you are upset or stressed, ask yourself, what judgments have I made here about myself or about others? And you might find that 6 or 7 times out of 10, you have made some judgment, and that judgment needs to be challenged. It may be that 3 or 4 times out of 10, you're not able to put your finger on any specific judgment that you have made now and are still feeling unhappy or maybe happy. These are ghost emotions. The ghost emotions are nothing but the real emotions that we experienced in a real life situation in the past. The situation has become irrelevant, but the emotion is still carrying on in our minds. These emotions go into the unconscious mind in seed form and then bounce back into the conscious mind after a certain gap. I'd like to explain the process of identification and disidentification with more details here. Identification basically means that we adopt somebody else's thoughts, viewpoints, behavior patterns, and make them our own. A child identifies with a parent, and children grow up copying their parents' value system, thinking, attitudes, mannerisms, and posture without questioning them. If a father thinks that rich people are tax evaders or watching sports on television is a wastage of time, children grow up with the same attitude. But when they become an adult, they start questioning the wisdom in the things that their parents had said, and they might disagree with some of their thinking. This process of disagreeing is called disidentification. This identification with a thought puts an obligation on us not to disagree with it and to act in accordance with it. Whereas disidentification frees us from that bondage. The thoughts that enter our mind can be classified in several categories: stray thoughts, induced thoughts, adopted thoughts, wild thoughts, daydreaming, and as opposed to all these categories, thoughts that truly belong to our real personalities. It's important to make this distinction so that we can identify with the thoughts that really belong to our personality and not with the thoughts that are induced or stray or adopted thoughts. I normally ask people to visualize their anxiety and depression in terms of the grease and the dirt in one's clothes that, although have gone deep into the fabric of the cloth, don't belong there and can come off. We have looked at our emotions, past and present, and how they color up judgments, and how to erase them by using the analogy of recording and playing of DVDs. My name is Kishore Chandiramani, and I welcome you all to the 4th in a series of 6 sessions on stress management. We are going to discuss the physiology of stress and how we can deal with it at the physical level by changing the heart rate variability, brain wave pattern, and the autonomic nervous system. Due to the advancement in technology, it has now been possible to accurately measure the parameters such as muscle tension, respiratory rate, skin temperature, heart rate, brain wave pattern, blood flow in different parts of the body, and skin sweat activity, which can reflect high anxiety states. The biofeedback devices can accurately measure these subtle changes in the physiological functions and convert them into signals, and one can visualize their stress scores on the computer and see them return to normal when they relax. This is quite empowering for clients who can see for themselves how their stress levels fluctuate with their mental and physical activities. The autonomic nervous system consists of 2 separate systems, sympathetic nervous system and parasympathetic nervous system. And these 2 systems are normally in harmony with each other. In anxiety and depressive states, this balance is disrupted, and there is high levels of sympathetic activity, which can be corrected by means of therapy techniques. Scientists have discovered that the heart rate variability is altered in anxiety and depressive states. The rate at which heart beats varies from beat to beat, even in healthy states. In fact, it is considered desirable to have a greater variation in heartbeat, as it has been reported that heart rate variability is lower in disease states. Researchers have found that this heart rate variability is being constantly influenced by our respiratory rhythm. This finding that heart rate changes with respiration has allowed scientists to modify heart rate variability by way of altering the respiratory rhythm. To put it simply, during a panic attack or anxiety attack, if your heart is pounding, you can't ask your heart to slow down. But there is a connection between your heart and your respiration, and your respiration is under your control. By changing your respiration, you can bring about a change in your heart rate, which means if you are able to breathe slowly, deeply, and using your tummy muscles, you can slow down your heart rhythm and abort a panic attack. The other important parameter that is involved in stress and can be altered is a brainwave pattern. There are 4 different types of brainwaves: alpha, beta, theta, and delta, each with its own function. It has been reported that in certain psychiatric disorders, such as anxiety, alcohol dependence, and addiction to sedative drugs, such as heroin, benzos, and opiates, the brain is over aroused, and use of alcohol or sedatives lead to a reduced level of arousal. That is, individual brings their arousal level to an optimal level, which produces a sense of comfort. Whereas individuals who suffer from attention deficit and hyperkinetic disorder and who abuse stimulants such as cocaine and amphetamine have under-aroused brains, and increased physical activity or the use of stimulants lifts their arousal to an optimal level, which is again relaxing for them. It is possible to alter the brainwave pattern and arousal levels of the individual with the use of biofeedback devices such as light and sound machines. This stress program places emphasis on learning a number of different ways in which one can stop forming new negative experiences. This opens the door for the old emotions to get worked on, and attention regulation is one of the key techniques involved. Every thought and every emotion dies its natural death if we don't pay attention to it. It's the attention that fuels the fire. Attention regulation is a very simple technique, but one that has to be practiced constantly for a sufficient period of time. The first and the foremost approach to attention regulation is to shift one's attention from the thoughts of the past or future to that of the present. If we look carefully, we find that whenever we get stressed, mostly we are either thinking about something which happened in the past, that is a few minutes, hours, days, or months ago, or something that is going to happen in the next few hours, days, or months. If we live mostly in the present, we can cut through a lot of stress. My name is Kishore Chandiramani, and I welcome you all to this fifth in a series of six sessions on stress management. The topic for today's discussion is understanding stress and its management using the knowledge from psychoanalysis and philosophy. Within philosophy, I have placed greater emphasis on existentialism and stoicism. Existentialism, which is a branch of philosophy, encourages clients to look at the core issues of human life and confront the inner pain rather than find escape into the distractions of the external world. Existentialism looks at the core issues such as meaning in relationships, being alone, separation, loss, death, free will, sense of responsibility, purpose and meaning in life, and sense of what is right and wrong. Clients with depression tend to indulge in regretful wallowing in past mistakes and misfortunes, or see themselves as victims of society. In therapy, they start exploring how they have allowed others to make decisions and control them. Existential therapy enables clients to examine the degree to which their behavior is being influenced by social and cultural conditioning. Depression can result from having a very high and unrealistic internal standards, that is, to be strong, loving, and good at all times, which results in depression when these standards don't match with the internal reality. Because of our romanticized notions of human life, we can't accept the reality of our existence and that of the external world. And this results in distortions in our perception of the reality. According to psychoanalysis, this distortion is achieved by means of use of different defense mechanisms such as denial, projection, displacement, intellectualization, rationalization, somatization, and so on. and psychiatric symptoms originate from these distortions. People are generally preoccupied with what they have, the house they live in, the car they drive, the jobs they have, their family members, and people they associate with. That is all left behind ultimately at the time of death. Whereas what goes with us, that is who we are, requires equal attention, if not more. Heidegger, another philosopher, sees the crisis of meaninglessness unavoidable to some extent. He understood human beings as constantly being caught between two positions of no longer and not yet, which can lead to a loss of meaning, as whatever we have achieved becomes no longer, taking away all the meanings with it. We know that different things matter to us at different times, but the fact that they don't hang together as some unified whole takes away their meaning. Sometimes in relationships, depression can occur as a result of problems in distance regulation. The distance between two individuals should be optimal, like the strings of a guitar. Being too close or too far apart will not produce good music. Another existential philosopher, Lacan, has talked about feelings of a lack, that something is lacking in life, irrespective of who we are and what we have achieved. According to him, all desires arise not from perception of the external world, but from an inner feeling of lack. This lack is not about lack of this or that, but about lack of being where the being exists. The being here refers to our own consciousness or true inner self. When it gets decentered, that is, a shift occurs in its focus from inside to the outside, it creates a feeling of a lack. Stoicism teaches the development of fortitude as a means of overcoming destructive emotions, and that a Stoic of virtue would amend his will to suit the world and remain, in the words of Epictetus, sick and yet happy, in peril and yet happy, dying and yet happy, in exile and happy, in disgrace and happy. According to Stoicism, we are disturbed not by things, but by the views we take of them. And if one is unhappy, he is unhappy by reasons of himself alone.
My name is Kishore Chandiramani, and I welcome you all to this final session on stress management. In this session, we'll discuss what heals in psychotherapy, the avenues to inner peace, and a recap of all the tools we have discussed so far in this program. Therapies that work at the conscious level are counseling, psychoeducation, cognitive therapies, and to some extent behavioral therapies. They help clients identify the unrealistic elements in their thinking and replace those with more realistic ones. Or they fill the gaps in our awareness with knowledge and information that can be used to manage our stress better. The second broad category is that of therapies that work at the unconscious level. and this includes mainly psychoanalysis, mindfulness meditation, experiential therapies, and existential therapy. The stages of change that are involved in the final common pathway are: first, activation of the past experience from the unconscious mind by a number of different techniques. Once those emotions are activated, the next step is to stay connected with them, no matter how stressful they are, as this is essential for them to get worked on. The third step is to understand those emotionally charged experiences from the past in a different way, that is, using the corrective therapeutic experience. Therapy is generally about eliminating the negative emotion, which results in experience of inner peace. But there are other avenues to inner peace as well, such as solitude, detachment, letting go, and surrender. To begin with, the first tool is to keep in mind that whatever one is experiencing through one's five senses and one's thoughts and feelings at any given moment in time is temporary. So the second coping mechanism or tool is to challenge all our judgments with a view to fine-tuning them. The third tool is to disidentify with our ghost emotions, the experiences that don't belong to our current situation and to our personalities. The fourth tool is writing an emotion diary. And I have explained elsewhere the theoretical rationale behind it and how it can work. The website www.undoyourstress.com has all the details. The fifth tool is manipulation of one's attention so that one lives in the present moment. And there are a number of different techniques, the most important being awareness of the breath. The sixth tool is breath regulation, which involves different kinds of breathing. The seventh tool is that of use of biofeedback devices such as light and sound machine and stress eraser. The eighth tool is that of using an existential approach to understand the true nature of our inner being and the reality of the external world. This links in with the next tool of coping, and I call it creating positive issues out of nothing. You must have come across people who create negative issues out of nothing. Things that are non-issues are made issues by them, creating a ripple of stress in their surroundings. In a similar fashion, one can think of being the person who creates positive issues out of nothing. The tenth tool can be described as social therapy, which is quite different from working on one's own negative emotions. The 11th tool is that of altruism. Finally, the 12th tool is that of detachment, or being indifferent to this world. Now, generally, these two words are used in a negative way in our daily conversation, but here they are being used to convey something positive. Detachment here does not mean adopting an uncaring or indifferent attitude to people. It means cutting off one's insecure attachments, which create a lot of neurotic anxiety. I hope you enjoyed the sessions. Thank you very much.